Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 coming to you from Matt Torgerson's office. I was expecting like a really nice Persian rug or something, because you're so cultured.
Yeah, right? Did you just call me Matt Torgerson?
Mads. Uh-huh. Torgerson. Did I say it right? Look at him. He's such a... You know, one of the things I love doing is I like catching up with you, because the language, C-sharp is a language that I've been using almost my entire career. Right when C-sharp came out, I switched from VB even before C-sharp was done, and so I've been following it almost my entire career, and I love checking in with you to see how things are going.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Things are going good. So last time we spoke about what's new in C-sharp 7.
Yes.
And then you showed me how to actually do stuff in C-sharp 7. I thought we'd spend some time today just sort of looking to the future, what's coming up.
Sounds great to me. Yes.
All right. So what's the new stuff that's coming up?
Well, so... We shipped C-sharp 7 in March timeframe, and then actually just a few days ago from when this is recorded, we shipped C-sharp 7.1. So we started having little point releases of where we drip in a few useful features here and there. But I thought it would be interesting to talk about the next major release of C-sharp,
okay,
where we sort of go for bigger features again, like we've done in the past major releases. So there's a couple of different things that are on the docket. Right now, the C-sharp design team, we meet 2 times a week for 2 hours, and we kind of really drill down and try to get to the bottom of some big, difficult stuff. And one of the things I like about what we're looking at for C-sharp 8 is it's essentially a bunch of features. I don't know if they have much in common if you look at them as features, but what they have in common is that they are addressing things that we have been trying to tackle or giving up on tackling for many, many releases.
I see.
And I'm still hopeful that we will actually get to deal with most of them in this.
So to be clear, for those that are watching, this is still in the planning stages. This is not going to come out next week or anything.
That's absolutely true. Yes, okay. Some of the features that will hopefully make it into C-sharp 8 are actually in active development right now.
Okay.
So we have prototypes. We've showed a few prototypes, very preliminary prototypes, even in public at conferences, but some of them are just on the drawing board, and even the ones that we have prototypes for are like very rough.
I see. So is there still, like, for example, if someone's watching this and they're like, I really like that, are they going to do that? Is there still time to do feedback and comments?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And as always, we are designing in the open. Every time we have a design meeting, within a few days, I go to my computer and I clean up the notes and I put them up on GitHub on the C-sharp lang repo under the .NET organization.
We'll put links below so you can go
perfect.
See
that. And then people can go there and see what did they discuss. You know, how stupid were they this time? You know, why don't they get it? You can kind of see the sausage being made, all those flip-flops and decisions and so on in real time. And then see as stuff progresses. And that's a perfect place, just an open place for everyone to come in and leave their feedback.
So let's talk about a couple features, 2 or 3. Why don't you name just 2 or 3 off the top of your head, and then we'll go into each one.
That sounds good.
Okay.
So the one that we are in right now, that's my brain is kind of steeped in right now, is what we call nullable reference types.
Okay.
Which is about trying to help you prevent null reference exceptions,
okay,
the most popular exception in the world.
And, isn't it the billion-dollar mistake?
Or it's a billion-dollar mistake, yeah. Yes. So I can show you a little bit of how... that was Tony Hoare who famously coined the billion-dollar mistake, because he invented the null pointer. And the way we kind of put it is, we're going to give Tony half of his $1 billion back, because nice. We're not entirely solving the problem, but we're helping you do a lot about it.
So null reference?
Null references.
And second?
Async streams.
Okay.
That's another thing I'll talk about. Sort of the next level of... You know, async was about eliminating callback hell for a lot of scenarios.
Sure.
Because whenever you code with callbacks, whatever people say, you're going to have way too many bugs and inefficient code and random things happening. Mm-hmm. Very hard to debug. And so async kind of eliminated that for a lot of scenarios. But where we didn't eliminate it is where you have like streams of asynchronous stuff going on, like streams of events or data that beams at you in chunks.
Is that like
or whatever.
Reactive type stuff?
It is very related to the scenarios that people use Reactive for a lot.
Okay.
But Reactive is, again, sort of, it's rooted in callbacks, and we'll do something better.
Cool. So next one. So we talked about nulls, we talked about streams, async streams, and what else?
Right. And so another one that we also have a prototype of is default implementations and interfaces.
Okay.
So that's more like it's a smaller feature, but what's interesting about it is that it's the first time in a long time that we're building a language feature that requires changes to the runtime. And so we kind of got together with the runtime team. We're like, let's do a feature together. And let's like, we haven't done that since generics. Right. Let's like roll out something together. And we'll see how that
works. That was C# 2, right?
Yeah, that's like a decade ago.
Wow.
So so it's interesting to warm up those muscles and maybe it's a nice feature in and of itself. We also use it as sort of a spearhead for how can we get into that game again of actually evolving the runtime and the language together rather than just doing compiler tricks on top of the existing runtime.
All right, so we have nulls, we have async streams, we have interface defaults, is that what you call them?
Yeah, default implementations and interfaces. We need a shorter name for it.
Anything else?
There's one more we can talk about if we get to it, which is sort of extension everything. Take extension methods and do extension properties and extension static things and operators and stuff like that.
All right, so let's go through each of the four things. Yep. Let's start with nulls. What are we thinking of doing here?
So we already have, for value types like int, we already have int and int question mark.
Right.
So we sort of have that built into the runtime and everything. So those are distinct domains, and if you say the type int, it can't be null, and if you say the type int question mark, then you can't just use it as an int. You have to check that it's an int, and
you can do some static checking of nullable.
Yeah, you kind of have to unpack it almost, right? Whereas for just as of old, for reference types, it's all kind of muddled together. So if you have a string s, it can be null, but you're also allowed to just say s.length, for instance, without any checking.
Right? This will explode every time.
And so this combination of allowing reference types to be null, but also allowing you to dereference them, that's the combination that gives you the explosions.
Sure.
So all the null reference exceptions come from the combination of allowing both of those two. Mm-hmm. And there are languages out there, even a few now in the mainstream, that are better at distinguishing between sort of expressing your intent. Like you can for value types in C#, being able to express your intent, is the reference type supposed, is this variable supposed to be null or not? Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what the feature is about. So we're going to let you use this syntax on reference types as well. So I can say string question mark, and that means a string that is supposed to be null. Not just that it can be null, but like it's intent. It's part of your model that this string is null. So you can have a method that returns string question mark that says, you know, beware that I will sometimes return you a null.
I see.
Then on the other end of things, when you have one of these guys, a nullable reference, the compiler will then be vigilant for you and prevent you from just sort of indiscriminately dereferencing it.
I see.
So if you have this sort of line of code, the compiler will come in and say, here, the feature is essentially adding a bunch of warnings. So you're adding the syntax and then adding a bunch of warnings. So it will warn you that you're dereferencing something that might be null.
Oh.
And then, of course, there are various things you can do about it. One of the things you can do about it is to check for null first. You can say, if s not equal to null,
or you could Elvis operator, right?
Yeah, so there are many things you can do. But if you start with this one, then the compiler will actually do a flow analysis. Like the compiler does flow analysis today for definite assignment.
Uh-huh.
And we'll plug into that analysis, and it'll actually track the value of variables, not the value itself, but whether it's null or not. So if you did a check to see that it wasn't null, then it knows that inside of the scope of this if, S is not going to be null, and it will remove the warning. Right.
That's kind of like the stuff that Anders was doing in TypeScript. Is
it
that
is
right?
Very related to what Anders is doing in TypeScript, and that is not accidental. Like I've talked to Anders a lot about this feature.
I see.
And a lot of their experience rolling it out is part of what we do. So so that's sort of the core of the feature. The combination of expressing your intent to be null and then tracking. The reason why, like, there are other ways you could do this. Like, a lot of languages use pattern matching, for instance, to distinguish whether something is null or not.
Sure.
And that introduces a new variable, maybe, that is then the non-null variant, if you were. Uh-huh. But it was important for us to make a feature that fits well with the code that people already have.
Oh, I see.
And so if you go through and say, that thing I've been writing all the time for the last 5 years, I'm not going to put a few question marks in where I intend things to be null, then you want your existing null checking code to be recognized. That say you want your ifs or your assignments into the variable or whatever. You want all that to count and make the compiler shut up, right? You don't want to have to use a new way of checking for null. We already have like 7 different ways of checking for null. So the idea is for the compiler to recognize in the vast majority of cases when you know it's not null, the compiler also knows it's not null and the warning's going to go away. There are other ways, like the...
But the pedantry came out here. I had to remove the end curly brace.
Oh, thank
my compiler
you.
Wasn't working.
Thank you. Yeah, there was a red squiggle in your brain there. Yeah, we don't have a red marker today.
Yeah, I wish we did.
Yeah.
So here's a question, because this is awesome. Mm-hmm. But what I'm thinking about is if I'm going, like say I already have a ton of code, mm-hmm. and I don't have this question mark in there, and there is the possibility of this being null, is this something I have to opt into when I'm in the compiler, or is it just going to give me a lot of error? I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, so the part I didn't tell you about yet is sort of the, so what if I don't put a question mark, right? Then... our intent for the language, this is where it gets hard for the with the sort of compatibility mm-hmm. aspect of it. This is all like, if you add new annotations and you express new intent with new syntax that wasn't there before, and you get new warnings, well, that's just a new feature.
Yeah.
But if you start giving warnings on existing code that was fine before, then that's a problem. And we want to move to a world where actually not putting the question mark means you don't intend it to be null.
That's the question, right?
Because
that's not exactly what's happening in current code bases.
Right. So that's fine today, but we are going to, that was my my internal compiler triggering there. We are going to now offer you a warning on assigning null or putting null into things that do not say that they want to have null in.
Oh, and I see and this.
That part.
That's cool.
That part is like a breaking change, right? You get warnings. It's only a warning, but still, a lot of people have warnings there. So that is sort of like, and that's sort of the whole point of the feature is to make you find existing bugs and make them go away, right? And the only way to find existing bugs is to actually give you some feedback on existing code. It's in the shape of warnings, right? So by its very definition, this feature is going to
help you.
It's going to help you by breaking existing code.
Now, here's the thing. I saw that Anders explained this exact same thing to me. I think it was last year. And he said he turned this on, and he found errors in his own compiler code for TypeScript.
Yes.
That he's like, oh, I would have never seen that. And so you're saying this is the kind of behavior that's going to happen to Sharp.
But you're absolutely right. There has to be an opt-in. There has to be a place where you turn this on. Uh-huh. Because existing code will get new warnings. The good thing is most of those warnings are probably bugs in your code.
Like
a big part of our design is to try to make sure that most of the warnings you get are actually legit. But you might not want to deal with that right now. And you might have tested your code, you might know better, or you might be shipping tomorrow and you don't have time to deal with your bugs.
Right. Or oversights, as we call them in my oversights.
That's a nice one. Yeah.
So what you're saying then is, if let's just say, for example, this string S, I did intend to be sometimes null.
Yeah.
To make the warning go away, you just put the question mark.
Yes, then you put the question mark. But that might lead to warnings in other places because you might now be using it in a way that's dangerous when you have null around.
Which is
so you're
still
pushing the warnings around until you fixed all your bugs, and then all the warnings are gone away.
Oversights.
Your oversights.
Yeah.
Okay. If that's how you like it. So the idea is that this feature is going to, the outcome, once you made all the warnings go away without turning the feature off, the outcome is that your code has been strengthened and is explicitly dealing with all the places where things can be null, where you're dereferencing things that are supposed to sometimes be null without checking. And so it's a feature that comes with new challenges in terms of how do you roll that out and how do you turn it on and off and so on. But it's also, I think, very useful in that it directly improves the quality of your code.
Awesome. So for this, then, there is an opt-in question mark for you to indicate, I do intend for this to be null sometimes. Mm-hmm. If you're moving from a code base that does not have this, it's an opt-in warning.
Yes.
And if it is a warning, then you should go and either question mark it and then see where else the warnings are, or you should explicitly say, no, this should never be null. Let's make sure that that's never null.
Right. And we do anticipate that there's going to be a few places where the developer knows that a thing is not null, but the compiler can't figure it out.
I see.
It may be, maybe you call to some helper method that checked it for you. Like I say, if not dot, the terrible extension method is null or empty.
Yeah.
is null or empty, right? So if I call that one, then I as a developer know that if it's not that, then S is not null after this call.
Yeah.
But the compiler can't know that this method guarantees that, unless like we do some extra special annotation magic on that method or whatnot. And so I just want to tell the compiler in this case, I know better. And the way you do that is what we lovingly, we have to rename this, we lovingly call the dammit operator. So essentially, if you have something nullable that you know it's all right to dereference at this point, you can put the dammit operator and then go and get the length here.
That's awesome.
It's like, I know better. And
the compiler says, okay,
right.
Your funeral.
Exactly. if you that's exactly right. If it was null after all, then you took responsibility by putting that bang right there.
I see.
And so it's kind of nicely symmetric to the question dot.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, check for null or say, I know it's not. Or, you know. It's, so
I feel like this is a lot of responsibility for me. Telling the compiler, look, I know better.
Yeah, but hey, that's essentially what you've been doing all your life, just without any syntax to sort of express it. At least now you can search for it.
Yeah.
And you can sort of see it. Whoever maintains your code can see where you made that decision.
Right.
It's like, in that sense, it's very much like an explicit cast, right? You put something in your code to take responsibility.
I see. Okay, makes sense. This is cool.
So that's nullable reference types for you. And that, like, the last month or so, we've been, like, deeply, deeply enmeshed in that. Like, I dream about this at night currently. So.
Well, that's awesome.
No, it's terrible. I can't sleep.
All right, so the next thing then, so we talked about nullability. The next thing was async streams, if I remember right.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about async streams.
Okay.
So as a quick reminder, right, with async, the idea is that you have things that we call tasks in .NET, other people call them promises or futures or whatever, so that are sort of a representation of a future result. And so an async method, might return task of int, and it does something. Let's just stay with the lengths here. I'm running out of your camera.
No, you're good. You're still good.
Okay. So let's not give it any parameters.
That's right.
So it will do something in here where it returns an int, return x, that you compute it somehow, and then whoever uses that will say await. Okay, so that's nice. It'll await the call. So you get the task back, and await is the magic in the language that, we should call it get length async, but there's no room on the board.
Sure, sure.
So you get the task back, and essentially what this lets you do is instead of taking that task and signing up a callback to it with the rest of the code, you just, when you await it and when it's finally ready, you just jump right back into your code right where you are in the middle of, let's say, a for loop that's inside of a try block that's inside of a finally.
Right.
That's, you know, so you kind of, all the difficulty of turning your code inside out that callbacks lead to, you essentially eliminated those.
Right.
That's the magic of await. But it only works for those single results. So imagine now that you have, which is, you know, increasingly common in cloud, mobile, connected situations, you have streams of stuff, right? Either because you go and ask a database, give me all your data, and it can't send it all in one time, but also increasingly things just are live streaming. Like
sure.
You keep getting data from a sensor in IoT scenarios. You get events from here and there, and those are also async, right? They arrive at certain intervals, but you want to process them in your own time.
Right.
Okay.
You want to free up other,
right.
For example, other computations.
Right, and you may want to take one at a time and so on. And so the idea is to have a new abstraction that is essentially the asynchronous version of IEnumerable.
So like the yield operator for coroutines, but reactive kind of way.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. So imagine that you have we call it iasync enumerable, which is it's just like enumerable, except that when enumerable of t, except that when you move next on the enumerator for it, that's an async operation, that's move next async. Okay.
Oh, I see. Like, this is, I do this, I do an IEnumerables and do yield returns of integers all the time, yep. which makes it look like I have this infinite list of things, right? And F-sharp's really good at this, yes. like lazy loading stuff. So you're saying this is a way of lazy loading enumerable of T, but in an async way to allow
yes.
execution.
So you don't block on the next one being computed, like you would with move next. Let's say you use link over it or for each over mm-hmm. it, right? Then you you essentially block on getting the next value if you sit in a for each loop and just eagerly suck them out. Mm-hmm. But it's very convenient to be able to write for each over them or to be able to use link queries over them. And so essentially, this is just a framework type, mm-hmm. but there's a language integration that lets you for each over these guys, just like you can a normal for each. If you're in an async setting and it's, we haven't exactly settled on the syntax yet, but it might be a wait for each or for each. Let's just say for each await, for each await, and then just normal for each loop, var of what? Let's say it's an async enumerable of strings, okay. right? Var s in
some object,
stream.
Yeah.
That we already declared that is an iasync enumerable of string.
Okay.
Now we have strings. And the expansion of this for each will then await the next move next every time around.
I see. And this is cool because let's just say you're an old school Windows program, right? The UI thread would usually get locked in this if it's having to wait for things. This what it will do is anytime it gets one of these things, it'll wait for the next one, but then start processing the UI thread, for example, the message pump or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it just does an ordinary await, if you will, but you get to use your usual language constructs to consume them with for each, for instance, mm-hmm. and to produce them with iterators, just like you talked about yield return, uh-huh. right? So you can have an async, let's say we have an async method that returns iasync enumerable of string that produces uh-huh. this guy. That has, you know, yield returns in it. So it'll have yield return this or that.
We'll have to do yield. Okay, I see.
And it's an async iterator. It combines async methods and iterator methods that you can await inside of it and you can yield return inside of it. And whenever you yield return, whoever's for reaching it then gets the next value and their await will trigger. And so
many that are looking at this might say this looks similar to like something like an observable or reactive extension.
Yes.
But it feels a little bit different. Where's the differences? Where
the difference is this is fundamentally a pull model. You ask for things, you get them. Observables are fundamentally a push model. And that means that whenever they have something, they will call the callbacks. Right.
Oh, okay.
And so they decide. The producer decides the timing of it and the thread that it gets consumed on. Whereas this is a pull model. You can bridge the two. One problem that the observables have with the push model is that they might push too much. They might sort of the consumer might be gorging on too much stuff
yeah.
because the callback gets called all the time. And then you kind of have to have a separate channel for doing back pressure, people call it, and uh-huh. so on. You kind of have to tell the producer, wait a minute, I'm gorging here. This is nice because the consumer says when they're ready for the next one, right? So it kind of has a notion of back pressure built in. It happens on the consumer's schedule, no faster than the consumer can consume it. Of course, also no faster than the producer can produce it uh-huh. because sometimes you're waiting for the next thing to come. But it's sort of like when everybody's ready, the next thing can go.
And that's interesting, right? Because there's this state machine in the background that might be finishing something up. And then it's like, okay, I'm ready for this. Oh, it looks like it's there. I can go to the next one.
Yes.
Instead of like getting dosing yourself with
right.
observable things.
Right. And now, of course, there's a lot of stuff that's using iObservable out there. And there's some elegant code that mm-hmm. combines iObservables very naturally. And so it's important also that we facilitate bridging the two. And uh-huh. But you can do that in a library fashion. You think about bridging an iObservable to an iEnumerable, a push model to a pull model. You essentially have to decide what policy to do that by. And that's actually very natural to build into an API, a bridging API, where you say, you know, when I move next, when I take the next one, I just get whichever was the latest, and I'm happy to miss some of the events that came while I was busy processing the previous one.
I see.
Or I want to buffer them up to 100 or as much as it takes, or I want to never get a buffered one and wait for the next one to come around. Right? You can sort of say your policy about how you want to consume what.
Oh, so you're like bridging an observable to an async enumerable in order to make sure that
yes.
there's some kind of caching if you need to.
Yes.
For example, if you have more than 1,000, it's like it's not really useful anymore, so start dumping
right.
them. That's interesting.
So it'll be an API where you have different imagine calling different methods, maybe extension methods on iObservable that all produce an iasync enumerable, but they do it in different ways. And you sort of make that choice when you get your enumerable, how do I want to consume it? Do I want to consume all of them? Do I want them all to be buffered? Do I want none to be buffered? Do I want one to be buffered? You know, you make that decision, the policy decision, when you bridge it. And so, and you can even do that here, right? Whereas in, let's say this is an iObservable, you say, dot, keep only latest.
I see.
Right? And then things just sort of do the right thing based on that. And you have right there in the code, you have your policy decision about which elements you want to see and how you want to wait for them.
And that's really interesting because some of the hardest code that I've ever had to write revolved around timing.
Right.
Timing things that I had no control over. And
right.
this is kind of a cool way to bridge both of those things.
Right.
All right, so we talked about nulls. We talked about async enumerables. The next thing we're going to talk about were defaults in interfaces.
Yes.
Is that right?
I think this is a quick one. This is, to be honest, this is a feature that we're stealing from other mainstream languages that already have versions of this. Java in particular is one of those features where they actually did something before us. It does happen. The idea, so the problem that this is addressing is that if you have an interface,
do something?
notify, whatever.
Nice.
And it has one method, which is something happened, right? Void notify or something.
Mm-hmm.
And people start implementing it. So I have a class that implements I notify. And now, if in the future I want to evolve that interface, I want to put another member on it that's useful, then I can't because I'm breaking people who are already implementing it.
Yeah, you have to make a new one that's I notify notify, you know, or I extra
yes.
notify.
So you get into this whole like generational thing with interfaces. Oh, that's the old version. This is the new one, and that gets nasty. And so this is just a little trick to say that let's say this. I don't know. Notify all, right? Void notify all. You want to add that later, and there's some kind of I don't know, an enumerable of things. S here. This feature lets you add other members to interfaces as long as they have a default implementation. Okay? So I can say that one will, you know, for each over all the S's and notify or whatever. Like I can implement it in terms of the other members of the interface.
And that's easy, right? Because it'd be just for each I in S notify.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, so there'd be some way that you can implement it in terms of the other members of that interface. And then if a class is free not to implement it themselves. Okay? And that just means all the existing classes continue to work. They will just have the default implementation of the new member, which they will now exhibit which their interface will now exhibit.
And that's kind of cool because later, for example, if this class in the next version is like, okay, this is still working, we can still use the new API, but now we want to opt in to some other methods that we want to override or implement.
Yeah, we can do this better, now let's do it. And anyone who sees the new version, they can implement all of the members if they want to. They're free to still not do it, but
what's the difference between this and an abstract class?
Well, the difference becomes less, right?
Yeah. It,
we're sort of crossing a magic boundary now and putting source code in interfaces. And a lot of people object to that on principle grounds, and I can see why. And it's sort of on us to kind of keep it very limited.
Uh-huh.
There are several differences. Interfaces, there's multiple, you can implement multiple interfaces.
Right. So we have multiple inheritance type
yes.
kind of things.
Yes, and we do have to deal with the fact that multiple interfaces put default implementations on the same inherited member and the clash and so on.
Oh, that is crazy.
But it's not actually that bad. And Java has the same, and they deal with it, and we're going to deal with it the same way, which is, it turns out not to be much of a problem in reality. And also, interfaces in C#, you know, are different than many other languages in that when you implement an interface, you don't actually necessarily, the class doesn't necessarily have the members of the interface. Right? Okay. Only if you choose to implicitly implement and make them public. So that means that the class itself does not change what members it has when you evolve the interface. Uh-huh. Right? The effect on the class itself is very minimal. It's only if you cast to the interface that the members become available and you can actually get at the default implemented.
Oh, I see. So I was confused there a little bit. So if you add another method to the interface and you have to implement it, if you're going to add it, that doesn't necessarily show up in the new class unless you...
Right. That was always the case with interfaces. Yeah. Right? If the class chooses to have a private implementation of the notify method, and what we call an explicit implementation, where it says, I notify dot notify.
And you could make that private. I didn't know you could do that. You could make that private.
Right. That's sort of the default behavior, actually. And it's only if you do an implicit implementation and declare a public member on C that implements the interface, only then does C itself have a notify member.
Well, what if you cast C as an iNotify? Does this cause an exception?
No, then this shows up. Then if you cast C to iNotify, then it has a notify member.
But even if it's private on the class?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
That's how C# works.
I did not learn something.
You learned something new. And so it kind of makes the effect of this pretty minimal on the classes that implement the interface.
I see.
Adding another member, unlike Java, adding another member to the interface doesn't add another member to the class.
Okay.
Because it never does.
Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of a cool thing. It's opt-in. For those that object to it, just don't use it.
Yeah.
For those that find it helpful, use it.
Right.
The last one you talked about said actually has to modify the runtime a little bit. Is that what you said?
This is the one, actually, where you have to modify the runtime.
Okay.
Because the mechanics of finding that implementation and executing it in runtime can't all be implemented by the compiler, and the runtime has to do a little bit of work there.
So this is good. I like this. The last one you talked about was extensions on everything.
Extension everything, as we call it. Yeah. So this is one that we haven't done. We added extension methods in C# 3.
Yes.
As part of the link package of features, if you will. And back then, we only really needed methods.
Yeah.
We sort of could have used an extension property as well. There's the famous count method as part of one of the link methods. That is a method, but maybe should have been a property.
I see.
But then again, maybe not, because it can be very slow. But we said, okay, methods only, that's fine. And that kind of led us down a syntactic path where that only worked for methods. Right, because the way you declare an extension is you have a static class, static class extensions, and then in here you define a static method, public static, some method.
This object
that
whatever
it is.
The first parameter is always this something.
T, right? But the first one is always this. This. Innumerable of t, whatever. So you can't really apply that. So that's just a static method with a special modifier. You can't really do that to a property. What's the first parameter of a property? Don't have parameters. We could invent syntax for that.
Well, it's a parameter to itself.
Yeah. So it kind of gets ugly fast. And for that reason, we sort of backed away from. We had a serious attempt in C# 4 to address this, and we ended up throwing it all out because it didn't actually work for the scenario we were building it for.
So.
But now we have an intern who's now actually a member of the compiler team, a very brilliant intern, implement an alternative syntax. So essentially the way to do it, and so we have a nice internal prototype for it that makes us think we could maybe do this. So the idea is instead of this minimal hacking of existing syntax, we need to step back and come up with a new syntax for extension everything, including extension methods. And so what we what we're thinking of is to have a new type declaration form that's called an extension. Let's just invent a syntax for it. Extension ext here.
And then you put
extends or whatever. Whatever class it extends.
Like person.
Extends person. And then in here you just do member declarations like as if they were on person.
Is it so what's the difference between this and because I remember before you could take two classes and separate them the same you could take the same class and separate them, right? A partial class. Yeah, it's a partial class.
Yeah, so it does it is a little reminiscent of that, but partial classes are actually they have to be in the same assembly and they're actually merged at runtime. Like the compiler just glues them together.
That makes sense.
Think of it almost like it's not entirely true, but think of it as the source code just gets glued together before the compiler gets them. Here, this can be on a type in a different assembly, and it doesn't actually modify the type. It does really work like extension methods do today, that the members live somewhere else. They live in a separate thing, separate type, even in the assembly that gets generated. But there will be thicker syntactic sugar, so to speak, right? Where it's if you want to have a method on person, you just put it as an instance method. You say public int whatever count fingers, and that's the syntax now for an extension method. No this anywhere, right? But you can use this keyword inside, and that refers
to
the person.
Instance of the person.
Yes. But then, of course, you could choose to instead make this an extension property now, where it's just the it's number of fingers instead. And
you can do a get and a set.
And then you do a get and set and whatnot, right? So you just use the same syntax as you would have if you declared it inside a person.
So here's the question, because notice that this number of fingers, get and set, are there private members of the extension class that you can keep track of? You see what I'm saying? Well, because let's just say for a person, I don't know, let's just say you wanted to, now people wear hats in your assembly that they never wore hats before, and you have a collection of hats.
Right.
Get number of hats. There's no hats in the original person object. Is it something that's going to be an extension?
Right. So that's one of the, I think we are not going to solve that.
Okay.
Right. The problem is adding state to the original object. We're not going to do that. So we're going to add things that do not rely on that do not rely on adding new state.
I see.
Because you get into issues about when is that state created? How do we keep track? You kind of need to have dictionaries floating around that sort of adds the. So if people want that, they can build it themselves, right? I can build a side table that keeps track of all the hats for all the people, and I can make a getter that looks up in that side table if I want to. But it's better that people do that themselves rather than the compiler does something too magical. Something that looks like it's a cheap field access, but really it looks up in a hash table somewhere. That doesn't seem like a good thing for the compiler to do. So if we do this feature, which there are many reasons why we might not, we'll probably not add instance state. Actually, we're happy to add static fields. So you could say static int. But then that's like you could put your dictionary in a static field inside of this. Because we are generating a new type, and that type can hold the static members.
And this is interesting because this is reminiscent of the terminology is escaping me a bit. In F#, for example, one of the ways of maintaining state functionally is to make sure once you set something, it stays the same way. Mm-hmm. Are you just trying to stay away from managing statefulness in these classes?
Yeah. I mean, that would be horrendous and not necessarily very efficient. It's something that people should choose to do themselves if they want to. But once you have this, so I just introduced a static member, and you can introduce other static members, and they now extend the person class in the sense that you can say person dot that new thing, or you can imagine it being an operator. You could say public static operator plus, right? Public static person operator plus, blah, blah, blah. And now, in scope of this thing, person now has a plus operator, or that means marry or something,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, plus, I don't know.
all kinds of, and including constructors as well.
Right? Wow.
So it has a lot of flexibility there.
So this is cool.
So that is cool. We'll see if we get to it. I kind of want to. And there's one way that this could go, but this is absolutely crazy, and I don't think that we will get to it in C# 8. But one thing you can imagine in the long run is to actually have sort of extension interface implementation. So you could sort of say, well, person doesn't implement iEmployee or whatever in general. That's not, the class just doesn't do that. They didn't know about iEmployee when they wrote the class. I could maybe say that it does implement iEmployee. And as long as I implement all the members of iEmployee in the extension, then I'm saying how person implements that interface.
That's amazing.
And that would be like super powerful, but it also, it's another thing that would require runtime changes and has all kinds of like corner case gotchas and all that. So,
interesting.
So that's sort of like more on the radar for research into the future. But it's just nice to think that extension, everything kind of gives us a way to move in that direction.
And the interesting thing is that this allows you, for example, type ownership is very powerful in an assembly because then you can do stuff with it. Mm-hmm. But if you're importing an assembly and you don't have type ownership, you can only do with the things that they specified. This allows you to expand, for example. So let's say, for example, in my assembly, I use employees and they use people. This is a way for me to merge functionality of two separate assemblies by controlling the types.
Yes, you can. You can essentially make an adapter mechanism through this.
Well, this is cool. So we talked about four things. Mm-hmm. We talked about nullability. We talked about async streams. Mm-hmm. We talked about default implementations in interfaces, and then we talked about these extensions in order to do I'm forgetting the term. Extension everything.
Extension everything.
I said the word, but I didn't do that. This is awesome. So where can people go to give feedback on what we just talked about?
They can go to the best place to keep up on what we're doing and see our current plans, our milestones, our proposals, is our GitHub site for C# language design, which is called .NET C# Lang.
Awesome, and I'll put it below so everyone can see it.
Excellent.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks so much for watching. We're learning all about what we're going to be putting in C# 8. If you have any comments, make sure to submit them below or also go to the website that we just talked about. Thanks for watching. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9. We'll see you next time. Take care.